All right. It looks like we've got sound. That's good. Welcome to Technocratic Tyranny Blues. This is Power, Corruption, Lies and Money, which is my theme for January 2023. And I found a documentary, 43 minutes long, 44 minutes long, on Bugsy Siegel. So this will complement the material that I'm posting about the other gangsters that are involved, the Jewish mob and Italian mob and everybody that's involved in New York and Las Vegas and Los Angeles and Prohibition and all that stuff. So this is going to complement all of that stuff. I don't know how good the documentary actually is, but I watched the first bit of it and it seemed all right. So I'm going to play it for 45 minutes, and then there's another one I think I'll play after this, so we'll get an hour and a half's worth of material, and I'll call that a day. That's enough to be going on with. But here is this Mafia, Benjamin Bugsy Siegel.
Benny was a powerhouse, and he got there by using his guns and his fists and his charm. Benny just did what he wanted to do.
They called him Baby Blue Eyes. They called him Bedroom Eyes. Every woman that met him just went crazy about him. But they were all, like, afraid of him.
He's smiling at you 1 minute, and the next minute you better run. Somebody would insult Virginia Hill. She'd tell Bugsy, Bugsy, you're chasing him down and shooting at his feet.
When he built the Flamingo, that became the beginning of the fabulous Las Vegas Strip, which became the entertainment capital of America.
The dashing, trigger-happy Benjamin Siegel, better known as Bugsy, was as charming as he was murderous. In the 1940s, the New York mob sent Bugsy to L.A., where he muscled in on the rackets and hobnobbed with movie stars. Then he fell for the beautiful mob girl, Virginia Hill. It was the most famous romance in the history of organized crime.
Lust, I would call it. Lust and obsession with one another.
Bugsy used his charm and millions of dollars from the mafia on the gamble of a lifetime. He gained control of a Las Vegas resort and casino called the Flamingo. Only Bugsy was way out of his league. His forte was murder, not business, and it showed.
He was a stubborn mob boss. He didn't know what he was doing, and he made every mistake, you know, you can believe.
Bugsy was in tight with the highest-ranking mobsters in the country, but that didn't save him when the mob decided that Bugsy was a bad bet. Benjamin Hyman Siegel was born in New York City on February 28, 1906. His parents, both Jewish immigrants from Austria, raised their five children in a cramped, rat-infested tenement in Brooklyn, just over the bridge from the crime-ridden Lower East Side of Manhattan. Escape from the squalid conditions became paramount to the Siegel children, most of whom did their best to get ahead through working hard in school. But little Benny Siegel preferred the streets to the classroom.
Ben was not of a disposition to want to go to school and try to get an education and get an ordinary job. Whatever it is he wanted to achieve, that route was much too slow for him. And I think that's what pushed him into an early life of crime.
Benny, a stocky kid, not yet 10, became a denizen of the bustling streets of the Lower East Side, a battleground for rival gangs of young Italian, Irish, and Jewish hooligans who made fast money by shaking down pushcart vendors. Benny quickly grabbed his own piece of the action.
They would do little protection games. They'd push over the pushcarts, and then they'd tell them, if you don't want the pushcarts bothered, give us a dollar each, you know, things like that.
A little cash and the rush of power made these young punks hungry for more. They copied the older gangsters and organized their own crap games right on the streets.
Have it under the street light at night and up an alleyway in the daytime. And you learned that if you wanted to run the game, you made more money than if you participated in the game. So entrepreneurship in the world of crime was something that they came by very easily.
By his late teens, Ben Siegel was a tough but small-time thug until one day a scrawny Jewish kid named Meyer Lansky stumbled upon him in a street fight, grappling over a gun.
The whistles, the police were arriving. And Benny seemed fixated on getting hold of this gun. He wasn't going to let go of it. He didn't seem to notice what was happening around him. And Meyer always took credit for taking him aside, saying, come, you've got to go. And he was totally ungrateful for this. As they ran off into the stalls, he said, I needed that gun. And somehow couldn't get over the fact that he'd left it lying on the ground.
A friendship was born between the street smart Meyer and Ben, whose growing reputation for violence set him apart from other young crooks of the day.
Benny was a one-man army. That's what they said about him. Benny was fearless. He was a little bit crazy. That's why the name, Bug.
People in the Lower East Side said he was crazier than a bed bug.
So Bug became Bugsy. You know that guy, he's Bugsy and so on. But as he made his way up, no one would use that name to his face.
The New York City underworld soon became acquainted with the odd couple of Siegel and Lansky, and the pair decided to start their own gang.
And he and Meyer Lansky started a thing pretty quick called the Bug Meyer Gang.
All right, I've just zapped the thing that I wanted to keep instead of the things that I wanted to zap. So let me just go back into BitChute. That was a bit of a nuisance, but it is what it is. So you're getting the principle of it anyway. So Ben Siegel and Meyer Lansky. Just get that back. Talk amongst yourselves for a second. Here we go. This is the one.
Benny was a powerhouse, and he got there by using his guns.
Hacking, robbery, bookmaking. Underworld soon became acquainted with the odd couple of Siegel and Lansky, and the pair decided to start their own gang.
And he and Meyer Lansky started a thing pretty quick called the Bug Meyer Gang, in which they did burglaries, they did, you know, hold-ups, they did all that sort of thing, you know.
Ben was the muscle that Meyer could use. Meyer was the brains when it came to some of the business activities.
The Bug and Meyer Gang also made money by fencing furs, jewelry, and cars. Then the U.S. government dropped a money-making scheme right into their lap, Prohibition. Supplying the illegal booze? Gangsters all over America. One of the biggest, Arnold Rothstein, was best known for fixing the 1919 World Series. He knew a golden opportunity when he saw one. Rothstein began to recruit promising young criminals to run his bootlegging operation for him. Bugsy and Meyer were among the first chosen. As a front, they set up a truck rental garage in Manhattan. The trucks would come and go at all hours, filled with booze.
Prohibition meant for the young criminals who were involved was that America was compelling them to become businessmen. Businessmen of crime, but businessmen nonetheless.
By age 21, Bugsy was already a success. In spite of a rap sheet that included charges of assault, drug dealing, white slavery, bootlegging, hijacking, robbery, bookmaking, and murder. None of the charges ever stuck since Bugsy was in with the big-time bosses like Arnold Rothstein, who knew the magic power of the payoff. Bugsy flaunted his freedom and his newfound wealth, the kind of wealth that few of his buddies from the ghetto could match by obeying the law. With his money, Bugsy bought class, starting with an apartment in the fanciest hotel in New York City.
Ben went to the smart new place, the Waldorf Astoria, where he could see and be seen, where he would eat breakfast, where he would go to the barber shop, and could be seen by the world.
Bugsy's new image was fortified by his movie star good looks and a charisma that beguiled the broads and masked the violence always lurking just below the surface.
They called him Baby Blue Eyes. They called him Bedroom Eyes. every woman that met him just went crazy about him. But they were all, like, afraid of him.
He was about 5'10 or 5'11. His stomach was flat as a tabletop. He was in some shape. He worked out every day.
In 1929, Bugsy singled out one of those drawn to his good looks, a dark-haired Jewish girl named Esther Krakauer. Bugsy used his marriage to build the appearance of respectability. He bought a Tudor-style house in Scarsdale, a pretty, quiet town just outside the city, where he and Esther could raise a family.
He had to be among the first Jewish people who could say that they lived in Scarsdale. This was an upper-middle-class residential neighborhood that frowned on anyone who wasn't a WASP. And yet Ben broke that barrier.
Bugsy had two daughters and split his life between his secret work in the city and his family in the suburbs. But he seemed like any other commuting breadwinner.
You would not know that, you know, that they're necessarily gangsters. They just were guys who all day long did what other people did. But then you can imagine what they were doing in the 30s and 40s when they were working. Work to them meant killing people, beating them up, and then they go and have dinner.
Ben did what most organized crime people do. They become the total schizophrenics. Wife, children, that's one world. This is business, and never shall the two meet.
Business got even better as Bugsy and Meyer shrewdly linked their fates to another young, up-and-coming gangster named Charles Lucky Luciano. The sharp-dressing Charlie Lucky had worked his way up in the Italian mob by carving out a niche in drugs and prostitution. But the ambitious Luciano was running into a major roadblock.
Young gangsters like Lucky Luciano found their way blocked by an older generation. Not really in terms of power. It was just their ability to do business in a rational American way was being frustrated by these old men. And it seems pretty clear that Luciano decided that these old guys, the Mustache Pete's, would have to go.
In the early 1930s, two powerhouses of that old generation, Salvatore Modenzano and Joe the Boss Masseria, were fighting a bloody street war for control of the New York mob. But they were too busy clashing to notice they were cramping the style of Lucky Luciano. In April 1931, Lucky lured Joe the Boss to Scarpato's restaurant in Coney Island. As Luciano excused himself from the table, four men walked in and shot Masseria four times in the head, killing him. With Joe the Boss out of the way, Joe's rival, Modenzano, took control, but not for long.
He had an office in a building right behind Grand Central Terminal, staffed with bodyguards, and Lucky Luciano decided Modenzano would have to be killed. But it'd be very difficult for his men to get close.
The best evidence is that it was Jewish hitmen that they recruited to do the shooting, and that Benny Siegel was one of these.
And they went up there just as cops were allowed in, and they killed him.
With the death of the last big old-timer, Lucky started running the mob like a modern corporation. He created the Commission, a governing body of mob bosses, a kind of board of directors, presiding over rackets such as bootlegging and prostitution. Lucky even let Jews, including Bugsy and Meyer, get a piece of the action.
His standard was going to be, can I make money with these fellows? If so, I don't care if they're Irish, I don't care if they're Jewish. Can I trust them, and can we make money together?
Their ethic was very much the ethic that had made American business great, except they were prepared to break laws, and where necessary, to back up what they wanted with violence. And Ben had this ability to intimidate people. And that, of course, is a very useful talent in business.
Because Bugsy had a natural aptitude for violence, he became a leader in the mob's very own assassination department, a notorious group of paid killers who became known in the press as Murder Incorporated.
They did the murders that they were instructed to do by the leading gangsters in Manhattan. When some violence had to be undertaken, Ben could have dispatched five of his men to do it. But he wouldn't dispatch them. He joined them and he would lead them. I think he enjoyed the violence to a very considerable degree.
But Bugsy's New York days were numbered. In 1935, Special Prosecutor Thomas Dewey launched a crusade against organized crime. His primary target, Bugsy's well-known boss, Lucky Luciano. Dewey nailed Lucky on charges of extorting prostitutes. The law was getting uncomfortably close to Bugsy, who, like his boss, made the mistake of basking in the limelight a bit too much.
He loved dressing sharply. We see it in his photographs. Houndstooth check, flamboyant ties. It was, of course, very dangerous. And what happened to Luciano showed it was dangerous.
There was another reason for Bugsy to make a change. The repeal of Prohibition in 1933 had signaled an end to the mob's biggest source of illegal revenue.
So they had to look for more fertile fields. And the thing that was coming along right around the time Prohibition ended, the early 30s, was gambling.
Bugsy's friend Meyer headed to Havana to lay low and to perfect his skills in the booming casino racket. But not Bugsy. For the dashing gangster with the celebrity good looks, the only place to be was Hollywood. The glitz and glamour of Hollywood, the guile and good looks of Bugsy Siegel. It was a perfect match. With his handsome face and the power of the New York mob behind him, Bugsy was dispatched to L.A. His mission? To muscle in on the West Coast rackets.
It was really rather daring of Siegel to come into Los Angeles and try and create some space for himself and his own associates. He seems to have done it with a combination of business and just crude violence and intimidation.
It wasn't long before Bugsy gained control. First of the bookmaking rackets, then prostitution and narcotics. He went on a spending spree, greasing the palms of police and politicians, buying a Hollywood estate and picking up tabs at the finest Hollywood hangouts. He was a master at mixing business and pleasure on a grand scale.
He was handsome, he was attractive to women, he could slap men on the back. If they had $100 they wanted to place on a horse at Santa Anita, he'd just take it off them. He made the whole process of breaking the law, as one had to do in those days, to gamble, very easy. And in that very hedonistic atmosphere of Hollywood in the 1930s, somebody like Ben Siegel fitted in completely.
So completely that the already fine line between movies and reality in Hollywood was blurred even more. Bugsy reunited with a childhood buddy from New York, George Raft. Raft had become one of Hollywood's leading actors, best known for playing gangster roles and hanging around with real gangsters.
Outsiders used to say, well, obviously George Raft is rubbing shoulders with these men to pick up tips. But the evidence of those people who were actually there goes the other way, that it was the gangsters crowding around George Raft and studying where he got his shoes made and who made his ties and his suits.
Within a short time, Bugsy was hobnobbing with Hollywood's big names like Gene Harlow, Clark Gable, and Jack Warner, attending extravagant parties and frequenting the Hollywood hotspots. Ciro's, the Brown Derby, the Trocadero. Bugsy's new friends introduced him to the film business. He was smitten. Rumors have it that he even did a screen test. But the movie industry appealed to more than Bugsy Siegel's vanity. He saw dollar signs. The gangster put the squeeze on studio executives by organizing movie extras and using the threat of mob violence to get his way.
Here we were, ready for production in a big MGM musical. And Ben would call him on a strike. And then they didn't have any extras, so they couldn't go in anymore either.
He was able to put the shake on these guys. In the movie industry, he was central casting. Even the guys that he was taken from, they loved him.
Bugsy Siegel was in his element. From the Sunset Strip to exclusive Beverly Hills estates on quiet, manicured streets, he was 3,000 miles and a lifetime away from the dirt and stench of New York City and his boyhood. Almost as remote were his wife and daughters, whom he had deposited in a large house in Hollywood. They took a back seat to Siegel's active social life. Among the many starlets and socialites who fell for Bugsy was the Countess Dorothy DeFrasso, an American woman married to an older Italian count. Together, she and Ben set out on true life adventures of epic proportions. On one occasion, the Countess brought Bugsy to her estate in Rome. Coincidentally, high-ranking Nazis Joseph Goebbels and Hermann Göring were in town on an official visit with Mussolini, and they were staying at the estate as guests of the Count.
Now, of course, this is before the war, but already it was very well known that the Nazis were anti-Semitic. Ben was furious to hear that these men were actually visiting the house where he was, and he wanted to go and knock them off straight away, to use his expression, shoot them.
The Countess talked him out of it, worried that the murders might upset her husband. In November 1939, back in New York, prosecutor Thomas Dewey's battle with organized crime was gaining momentum. Bugsy's mob friends were starting to sing. Bugsy found out that Harry Big Greeny Greenberg, a fellow veteran of Murder Incorporated, was one of them. The mob put out a contract on Big Greeny, who decided to make himself scarce in L.A. Bugsy was appointed to supervise the hit.
He would have been able to delegate the murders to some of the younger men in Murder Incorporated, but Ben pulled the trigger for those shots that killed Big Greeny.
After the Big Greeny murder, someone leaked information about it to the police. Information pointing to Bugsy. Only this time, Bugsy could not buy his way out of trouble by greasing the right palms. He was charged with murder.
When Ben was first indicted in Los Angeles, he demanded the return of the $30,000 contribution that he had made to the campaign of the sitting DA. And the DA was flabbergasted, but he got $30,000 up and gave it back to Ben Siegel.
Bugsy found himself awaiting trial behind bars, but he was not an easy guy to keep there.
Stories started circulating of Ben Siegel having been seen here and having been seen there and even taking a haircut at his old barber's. He'd been living the life of a prince in jail. He'd been allowed to go out for the afternoon and see a girlfriend and have a nice lunch and then come back in.
Since his earliest days in New York, Bugsy had always beaten the rap, and he wasn't about to change now. While Bugsy was enjoying his stay in jail, L.A. prosecutors, with help from New York, were preparing their case. They had three key witnesses whose identities were being kept secret for their own safety. They labeled the men X, Y, and Z. Y was Bugsy's very own brother-in-law, Whitey Krakauer, who had taken part in the Big Greeny murder.
Whitey Krakauer, although he was cooperating, was at large and in charge of his own movements. Somehow, Ben became aware of the fact that he was Y. If he didn't know it for a certainty, he suspected it. And Ben ordered the murder of his own brother-in-law, Whitey Krakauer.
That left only X and Z, both in protective custody back in New York. Then X mysteriously fell to his death from a hotel window. With just one witness still alive, the DA's office decided it no longer had a case. Bugsy Siegel once again beat the rap. While celebrating his success at staying a step ahead of the law, Bugsy had a chance encounter with an alluring woman he had once known back in New York. Her name? Virginia Hill. Bugsy Siegel's legendary lover, Virginia Hill, was his closest companion for what became the most dramatic chapter in both of their lives, the pioneering of Las Vegas. Virginia had launched her own career in the mob as a teenager from rural Georgia when she made her way north to Chicago during the 1933 World's Fair. She was hoping to trade on her raw sex appeal.
Virginia was very tall, long, beautiful legs, and she used to love to wear big hats.
Her sultry good looks landed her a job as a dancer and then as a waitress in a mob-connected restaurant. One day, one of Al Capone's men noticed her and put her to work. The mob taught her to launder money, place bets at the track, and smuggle drugs. She was rewarded with jewels, furs, and cash. In the mid-1930s, the Chicago mob sent Virginia to New York to keep an eye on a number of business deals, one of which involved East Coast gambling boss Joe Adonis. Virginia recognized Power and seduced him. They became an item. In New York, Virginia also met the dashing Bugsy Siegel. Bugsy hated Joe Adonis. The two gangsters were rivals in everything, including women. It wasn't long before Bugsy made a move on Virginia. The chemistry was right, but the timing was not. After a one-night stand, they went their separate ways. But they would meet again in Hollywood. By the late 1930s, as Bugsy was rapidly establishing himself as a mafia powerhouse in L.A., Virginia arrived in town on a mission to recruit gamblers for the Chicago mob. Virginia found her niche in the glitter of Hollywood, where she kept two mansions: Falcon's Lair, Rudolph Valentino's old house on Laurel Canyon, and 810 North Linden Drive in exclusive Beverly Hills. She threw huge parties and made the rounds of all the in places, the same ones Bugsy frequented. It was only a matter of time till their paths crossed. Now, the timing and the chemistry were right.
Lust, I would call it. Lust and obsession with one another.
The people who knew Virginia Hill and Ben Siegel felt they were made for each other. Their personalities were very like. They say opposites attract, but these were two people who were very like. Virginia Hill had a temper that could flare up. So did Ben.
Well, she had a mouth like a truck driver. Even though Ben had never sworn in front of me, he thought that was great. He used to say, "Would you believe her? Isn't she something?"
Virginia's wild nature ignited Bugsy's already explosive personality.
Suddenly, it was like adding gunpowder to the mixture. They both seemed to have this heedless indifference to what the world thought.
You're smiling at you one minute, and the next minute you better run. Somebody would insult Virginia Hill. She'd tell Bugsy, "Bugsy, you're chasing him down, shooting at his feet."
Bugsy and Virginia couldn't get enough of each other. They spent countless days and nights in Virginia's Beverly Hills home. Bugsy's marriage didn't cramp their style.
His own family was then living down the road in another fashionable area known as Holmby Hills. I don't think his wife Esther and his children ever wanted for anything, and he felt he had discharged his duties and obligations to them in that way, and Virginia Hill was an entirely different world.
Bugsy and Virginia became the king and queen of the Hollywood underworld. Together, they ran the numbers rackets and drug smuggling. Virginia guarding the interests of the Chicago mob, Bugsy protecting those of New York. The two rivaled each other in their ability to go through money. On one trip to the jeweler, Bugsy spent $19,000 on Virginia. One night, Virginia picked up a $7,500 tab at Ciro's, the place to be seen. Waiters loved her. She was known to tip with $100 bills.
She'd go out and think nothing of spending what another family might consider a year's income on one shopping spree. She was kind of somebody that he could hang on his arm and in his circle say, you know, look at the jewelry on her, look at the furs, the gowns, look at the shoes. You know, I supplied all that. So he would take almost as much pride in those things as she would.
But in 1941, Bugsy felt the need scenery. By this point, he had managed to beat the murder rap in the big Greeny Greenberg case, but the bad press was making it tough for Bugsy to do business. So he and fellow gangster Moe Sedway looked to the desert to extend their bookmaking rackets. Only 300 miles to the east was a sleepy little town where gambling was legal. Las Vegas.
Ben, Moe, and I were the first ones to go down into Las Vegas. There was only one road going out to Las Vegas, and with two tire tracks through the sand. And we went into Vegas, and I thought, gee, what do they want with a place like that?
According to legend, Bugsy saw an oasis in the desert with bright lights, luxurious accommodations, and gaming tables. But in reality, the vision of a gambling mecca belonged to someone else. True to form, Bugsy would muscle in on another man's dream and make it his own. When Bugsy Siegel first set foot in Las Vegas in the early 1940s, it was a dry, dusty, and remote outpost fit for cowboys, hardcore gamblers, and not much else. Gambling had been legal in Nevada for 10 years, and Las Vegas, 300 miles east of Los Angeles, was a lot closer than the casinos of Havana or Monte Carlo. Only Vegas casinos were anything but classy. Most of the casinos were already connected to a wire service which reported results from horse races all over the country. Bugsy and mob associate Mo Sedway promptly took it over. Then Bugsy turned his attention to the casinos themselves.
He actually tried to buy one of them, El Rancho Vegas, and the owner, who'd heard about his reputation, took some credit for turning it down. Siegel at that point seems to have formed a consortium which went into another casino, the El Cortez, which they bought into and sold out of quite successfully 6 months or so later, having made a nice profit.
Sometime after his arrival in Vegas, legend has it, Bugsy peered out into the desert and through the shimmering heat had a vision of a luxurious hotel with every conceivable amenity and a lavish casino attached, a mecca of gambling. In reality, Bugsy did peer out into the desert, just 7 miles beyond the town, and saw the beginnings of the newest Las Vegas hotel and casino, the Flamingo, being built by a well-known Los Angeles businessman, restaurateur, and compulsive gambler named Billy Wilkerson.
My father had a gambling addiction of enormous proportions. He never gambled less than $500 a day, and that escalated up to $50,000 a day. And a friend of his gave him a significant piece of advice, and that was, if you're going to gamble that kind of way, own the house, build a casino. And that's what led him to the Flamingo.
Wilkerson's idea was to have a more glamorous, glitzy, Hollywood sort of place to which Hollywood stars would fly.
It was this huge complex that housed a casino, showroom, restaurants, shops, a 200-room hotel. In a sense, like a Disneyland for gamblers.
But in January 1945, Wilkerson's gambling problem got the better of him. He lost the money needed to finish the Flamingo. Construction stopped. Bugsy spotted the opportunity of a lifetime. With the backing of his mob colleagues, including Lucky Luciano and Meyer Lansky, Bugsy offered to invest in the Flamingo. The desperate Wilkerson agreed.
It was a month later that three men arrived in the construction site. They were Mo Sedway, Gus Greenbaum, and Bugsy Siegel. And Bugsy Siegel stuck out his hand and said to my father, I'm your new partner.
Like most people that aren't in the mob, you don't become a partner for long. So Billy was squeezed out eventually, and Bugsy took over the whole operation.
Suddenly, Bugsy Siegel, who knew nothing about building or running a hotel casino, was basking in his new role as head honcho of the Flamingo. From now on, he claimed that the resort was his idea all along.
Getting hold of the Flamingo seems to have gone fatally to Ben Siegel's head. And his grandiosity seems to have been stoked by Virginia Hill. The two of them got wrapped up, as people tend to when they're gutting and renewing a property.
Bugsy launched into the project with a frenzy. He had promised his investors it would open the day after Christmas, 1946, less than a year away, a nearly impossible task. He insisted on the most expensive furniture and fixtures, and even the most basic construction materials cost a fortune.
He was in a tough situation because it's immediately following World War II when there were shortages of many building materials. He didn't want to be held back, so he'd pay whatever it cost.
Not only was the material expensive to begin with, but when Bugsy was duped into paying for the same items two, sometimes three times, the cost spiraled.
He wanted palm trees. Well, they'd send palm trees up on the truck, and then palm trees at night would go back down to Baker or Barstow. And the next day, palm trees would come back up, and he bought the same palm trees, I think, at least 10 times. And they're expensive, and that's where the money was going. The money was going into things he was buying over and over again because he had no idea. And yet he was a stubborn, you know, he was a mob boss. He wanted to control it. And he made every mistake, you know, you can believe.
Bugsy was also forced to pay extra for fixing construction mistakes. One overrun stemmed from a problem with the support beam in the ceiling of his private suite.
The beam was 5'8" from the floor, and he was about 5'10". And he called me, and I was in my office. He said, get out here. He said, he was so mad he was burning the wires. And I got out, and I walked one side of the room, the other. Didn't bother me. I was 5'6", so it didn't bother me. And he showed me that he couldn't get one side of the living room upstairs to the other without stooping. He was livid.
Bugsy also discovered a design problem in the hotel kitchen.
One day Ben went in and was behind the counter or something, and he bent over and his butt hit the one of the hot stoves. They made some changes in that pretty quick, you know, because his butt got burned.
Bugsy was burning a hole in his pocket on a much larger scale, and his investors were getting singed as well. Within a matter of months, the projected cost of completing the Flamingo had jumped from $1 million to $4 million. Bugsy approached his old friend Meyer Lansky, hoping to convince the mob to put up more money. The mob turned him down.
They were not accustomed to that in the world where they operated, and they were their tolerance level was diminishing very, very rapidly.
Siegel's reaction to this was to panic and become more violent and more threatening and more full of rages. Virginia was the one person he could turn to, and she was a very bad person to turn to because she had her own faults, her own grandiosity, her own short temper, her own demands that she made on him.
Bugsy began to grow paranoid. He built secret passageways, one starting from a trapdoor hidden in the floor of the closet in his suite and leading to a hallway in the bowels of the building, a project which added to the Flamingo's skyrocketing price tag. Bugsy's business problems were magnified by woman problems. By the summer of 1946, his wife Esther had had enough neglect from Bugsy and humiliation from his very public affair with Virginia. Esther went to Reno, Nevada, and got a divorce. She was awarded $600 a month in alimony and custody of both children. The end of Ben's 17-year marriage failed to bring peace to his relationship with Virginia.
When they would have a fight, she would throw everything she could get her hands on. Wherever they stayed in his room, he had a suite there. Everything was broken. Lamps, ashtrays, it didn't make anything different. And the help would stand out in the corridor, me too sometimes, and listen to it. And then after they'd have this big fight, then they'd make love like you wouldn't believe.
One afternoon, Flamingo architect Richard Stadelman discovered yet another use for Bugsy's bedroom.
He said, "I was called up to Bugsy's suite in the middle of the day. And there was Bugsy and Virginia Hill in bed, naked. And they received me and told me exactly what they wanted. Fortunately," he said, "it was about construction and design." So it took him a little while to get over this and a few drinks.
Bugsy was racing to finish the Flamingo for the grand opening, but as the deadline drew near, only the casino, the restaurant, and the showroom were finished, and just barely. The hotel rooms were not. Fellow mobsters warned Bugsy to delay the grand opening celebration until the hotel was completed, but Bugsy didn't listen. December 26th, 1946, torrential rains beat down on Las Vegas. Opening night at the Flamingo was a bit of a washout. Band leader Xavier Cugat and comedian Jimmy Durante performed as planned, but most of the celebrities Bugsy invited couldn't make it because planes weren't leaving L.A. in the storm.
The opening was jammed, but more with curious locals than with the celebrities that Siegel had been counting on.
Bugsy's opening was also plagued by nagging construction mishaps.
They had a big problem because the kitchen doors were swinging in the wrong way and waiters were falling all over the place with big trays because somebody was coming in when they were going out and went the wrong way. And Virginia's screaming at him, "You dummy."
But the costliest problem was the lack of hotel accommodations for the hordes of local gamblers trying out the new casino.
You couldn't have gotten in that hotel with a shoehorn, but they lost the players because they went to the El Rancho on the Frontier after they either won a big or lost big. They weren't able to hold them. They were ruined.
Over the next few weeks, the Flamingo limped along, losing money. On February 1st, Ben closed the hotel for a month to finish construction. He reopened in March 1947. Now, Bugsy was like a mother hen, attending to the details of running the Flamingo. His friends and colleagues got a rare glimpse into the management style of the charming killer turned hotelier.
We were in the bar in the cocktail lounge one night. A young lady and a man, and the cigarette girl gave her a pack of cigarettes. And she paid for it. And he called the cigarette girl over and he said, "If you ever have a lady seated with a gentleman and she orders cigarettes and he doesn't pay for them, don't you accept any money. You come to me and I'll pay you for it." He was a real gentleman in public. I always find him that way.
But Virginia did not always enjoy watching Bugsy play the part of the charming casino boss.
And a beautiful blonde girl came through the front door of the Flamingo and walked over to Ben. And she was asking for a job. So Virginia says, "Look what's going on up there. We'll see how long he's going to take him to say no, she's not getting the job." So he was talking too long. to the girl, as far as Virginia Hill was, didn't please her anyway. So she picked up her drink, and just like she was throwing a football, and she threw that drink all the way down the bar and it went right between their faces, the girls and Ben's. I don't know how it missed them, unless he saw it coming. But boy, that girl went out the front door so fast.
Ever so slowly, the Flamingo was beginning to creep out of the red, but not fast enough for the Mafia. Lucky Luciano and Meyer Lansky were demanding a final accounting of the money they had sunk into the project. Bugsy was stalling. For the first time in his life, Bugsy was in over his head with the mob. Bugsy Siegel was in trouble. The Flamingo Hotel project soared millions over budget, and by the spring of 1947, there were rumors that Virginia Hill, or Bugsy, or both, were stealing from the mob. Mafia leader Lucky Luciano was losing patience with Bugsy and his pet project. It was becoming increasingly clear that Bugsy was bad for business.
The investors felt he had to be replaced, and they knew his personality. They knew that you don't walk in and say, Ben, we've decided on a change in management. You can remain as an investor, but you're out of the picture. So I think the decision was made that the only way to tell him he was finished was to finish him.
Even Meyer Lansky, one of the big investors, could do little to help his boyhood friend, Bugsy.
I think he ignored some of the warning signs he must have gotten from Lansky. Lansky reluctantly and probably sadly just stepped back and let others handle that matter.
The tense situation was taking its toll on Bugsy's relationship with Virginia. On June 19th, they had a huge blowout that couldn't be fixed with a little lovemaking. She boarded a plane bound for Paris. It was said that the mob had warned her to keep away from Bugsy.
I think Virginia Hill was a very streetwise lady who knew how so-called gangland operated and took flight.
After Virginia left, Bugsy returned to Los Angeles to attend to some business. June 20th, 1947 began as a good day for Bugsy Siegel. He got a shave and a haircut at Drucker's in Beverly Hills. He palled around a bit with his old friend actor George Raft and had a few Flamingo-related business meetings. He ran into a gambling buddy named Alan Smiley and invited him to dinner. They dined at Ben's favorite steak joint with Virginia Hill's brother Chick and his girlfriend Jerry. Afterwards, the group returned to Virginia's mansion at 810 North Linden Drive. Chick and Jerry, who were staying at the house, went to bed. Smiley and Bugsy relaxed in the living room. Bugsy was reading the LA Times. It was 10:30 p.m., and the house was quiet.
He was seated at a couch when a man crept up through the shrubbery against the window.
Somebody put a carbine on the trestle outside the living room.
9 shots ripped through the silence.
One bullet penetrated his eye socket, and the eyeball was actually found on the other side of the room.
The second bullet shattered the back of his neck, broke his nose, and smashed his other eye. The last 7 bullets lodged into the walls and furniture. Bugsy Siegel was dead.
It was a very merciful death. It looked gruesome, but it was instantaneous. He never knew what hit him.
News traveled fast that night, across the desert to the Flamingo Hotel in Las Vegas.
I got the hotel, I found out he'd been killed. And that was a shock to me. That was, I say, everybody in the hotel was crying. But the first guy I saw when I got there was Moe Sedway.
Moe walked up to the microphone within 5 minutes after it happened. Flamingo Benjamin Siegel is dead.
It was a classic mob takeover. That night, Virginia Hill was somewhere in Europe.
I often wonder where she was when she first heard the news. Was she in a nightclub? Was she in her bedroom in a hotel? Or did she hear it over the radio? Or how did she hear it, you know?
Even in death, Benjamin Siegel had style. He was buried in a $5,000 silver-plated casket. Only 5 mourners were at his funeral. His ex-wife Esther, his 2 teenage daughters Barbara and Millicent, his brother Maurice, a respected Hollywood physician, and Bessie Soloway, his favorite sister. The ceremony took 5 minutes and was over before the funeral home officially opened for the day. In the years following Ben's murder, Virginia Hale tried to lead a quieter life. She married an Austrian ski instructor, settled in Washington State, and had a son. But her past would not leave her alone. In 1951, she was called to testify before Congress about the mob and Bugsy.
And when I was with Ben, he paid for everything.
By Ben, you mean Ben Siegel?
Yes. And he gave me some money, too, and bought a house in Florida.
The government nearly caught up with her in 1954 on charges of tax evasion, but she fled to Europe. On March 24th, 1966, Virginia Hill was found dead on a mountaintop in Austria. Her death was ruled a suicide, but some people believe the mob, fearing she knew too much, murdered Bugsy's baby. Bugsy's murder has never been solved, but few doubt that the mafia was behind it. His dream of success in Las Vegas came true, not for him, but for the mob and those who followed in its footsteps. Bugsy's life was the stuff of myth. The compulsion of one man to inhabit two worlds at once, embrace.
All right, so that's the end of that particular documentary. There we go. There's nothing else there. So I've got a whole lot of post-it notes with lots of names and places and dates on them stuck to my kitchen cabinets now, and I shall be investigating further, all of those things. So that's enough for now, though. I'm worn out with gangsters for the time being, but I should be back maybe later on this evening, maybe tomorrow, definitely tomorrow, maybe later on this evening, though.